Hello and welcome to this special science podcast from the 2010 AAAS Annual Meeting in San Diego, California. It's February 20th. I'm Robert Frederick. In this short podcast, we'll hear about the science of superheroes and the inherent challenges and rewards of depicting science in the popular media.
This is Helen Fields. I'm here with Jim Kekalius. He's a physics professor at the University of Minnesota, and he's the author of the book, The Physics of Superheroes, and he was science consultant for the movie Watchmen. He spoke at a session on the science of superheroes. So we all know comic books are full of things that are physically impossible. Are they a good way to present science?
I think they actually are, for at least some of the students. Certainly the traditional ways we have of teaching physics work perfectly well for many students. They worked fine for me. But there are other students that are never going to become scientists or engineers, but they're going to be citizens and voters for the rest of their lives. And the traditional ways we have of teaching physics turn these students off. Many students actually find science dull. These students are always complaining, when am I ever going to use this stuff in my real life? Interestingly enough, whenever I use superheroes to illustrate science concepts, students never wonder when they're going to use this in their real life. Apparently, they all have plans after graduation that involve spandex and patrolling the city and knowing how many evil, mad scientists there are out there. That's probably a good thing.
So how often do comic books get it right?
Well, you have to cherry pick often. Certainly, the heroes, the powers themselves are just physically impossible. And so I don't see my job as just going around showing how everything is wrong, you know, being Professor Grump or Dr. No or something, saying this could never happen and this is impossible and what's the deal with the Hulk's pants anyway. So what I do is I grant each character a one-time miracle exemption from the laws of nature and say, well, if you were super strong or could stretch like a rubber band or run at super speed like the Flash or Dash from the movie The Incredibles, could you run across the ocean or up the side of a building, catch bullets in midair, drag people behind you in your wake? All things that these characters are shown doing in the comic book, all things that are consistent with the laws of physics once you make that one suspension of disbelief.
So Dash or the Flash could run across the ocean?
At the speeds that they typically travel, it'd be hard for them not to run across the ocean. You know, we can go across the surface of the ocean if we can get high enough velocities on a water ski. We're pulled behind, and there it's not even that fast. But you're moving and trying to push this incompressible fluid. You're striking it and faster than it can respond and get out of the way. And so as long as you do that and keep moving on, then yes, it's not at all unreasonable.
So one of the things that stands out about comic books is the visual element. There's things to look at. Do you think that the visual element to comic books makes it easier for people to understand these scientific concepts?
In some cases, yes, I do. Because, again, there's lots of different ways that people learn. We now have a better understanding of how people can grasp information. And for some, visual aids really help. This is why the physics textbooks, the biology textbooks are crammed full of color illustrations. And so the superheroes themselves, those illustrations, if they're illustrating something correct, and if you have a guide, say, to point out where the correct science is as opposed to the incorrect science, then yes, it could help. Certainly by also tying it into a storyline or a narrative makes it easier for some people to retain.
So are there any superpowers like flying or invisibility that we would think are impossible but actually might happen?
Well, certainly it might happen via technology, right? And if you're willing to grant technology, then flying, yeah, we've kind of got that under control. The invisibility, people are working on issues like that of developing materials called metamaterials that have what's termed a negative index of refraction. So the light bends around these objects and then comes reforming. And if the way we see things is that light reflects off of a surface and then is detected by our eye. And if the light is not reflected but bends around the object, it's as if the object is not there as far as our eye is concerned. So that would be a form of invisibility. We've now been able to make materials that can be invisible to one specific frequency in the microwave region of the electromagnetic spectrum, and if you look in one direction. But we are a long way away from invisibility cloaks or things like that. But by analyzing this and looking into what would be involved, what miracle exemption from the laws of nature would be required, it helps give you insight into how the processes work in the first place. Not so much how would you turn something invisible as turning it around, why do we see anything at all in the first place? Why do things appear to us that we can see? There are lots of things that are invisible, like, you know, say window glass, that aside from the reflection from the surface, the light passes through that. How does that work? And so it's a nice venue to get at some real-world science.
What are some of the ways that you've used comic books to talk to, you know, a non-technical audience about physics?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. I've talked about forces in motion, referencing the death of Spider-Man's girlfriend, Gwen Stacy, in Amazing Spider-Man number 121, published in 1973, where the Green Goblin, one of Spider-Man's arch nemesis, knocks his girlfriend off the top of a bridge. She falls to her apparent doom. Spidey catches her in his web at the last second, brings her back up to the top of the bridge, and discovers to his horror that she is in fact dead, even though he caught her. And it was a key big deal in comic book history at the time, and still is today. It was one of the first times that an innocent bystander, a long-standing recurring character, died when the hero and villain fought. And it's been over 30 years, and Gwen Stacy is still dead. Usually when someone dies in a comic book, they eventually get better, but poor Gwen still is dead. But we can analyze what happened from a physics point of view. If you fall from the top of a bridge and fall 300 feet, neglecting air resistance, how fast are you falling? About 95 miles per hour. How much force would the webbing have to exert to stop her in about half a second? It turns out to be about 9 Gs, 9 times the acceleration due to gravity. So it's not at all unreasonable that her neck would break. It would be surprising if that wasn't the outcome. And then you can bring in and point out that this is why we have airbags in our cars. Because you're going at 60 miles an hour and your car hits something and you keep going forward. Because an object in motion remains in motion until acted upon by an outside force. That outside force is coming up in a moment. It used to be supplied by either the steering column or the windshield, which were very rigid, so the time available to stop you is very short, so the force is very large. Airbags do two things. They spread the force over a larger area, so the pressure is reduced. And more importantly, they deform under contact. They give a little bit. And the longer the time, the less force needed to stop. And that is a principle of impulse and momentum. It's basically a way of re-expressing Newton's second law of motion. But it's then put in a context that people remember and people can grasp and hold on to. So there are examples like this that are, you know, later on in the very same comic, there might be illustrations of things that are completely wrong from a science point of view. But you can take those few correct applications and use them and build on them to illustrate physics principles. And once you've illustrated the concept, you then show how it ties into everyday life. So it's basically the science of everyday life, but teaching some real-world science by very sneakily hiding it in a superhero ice cream sundae.
You seem to know your comic books pretty well. Why do you personally like comic books? Is this something, you know, did you collect them as a small child?
Mm-hmm. Well, I read comics as a kid. I collected them. I gave that up in high school upon discovering girls, a discovery that I'm not given enough credit for in the scientific literature, but that's something I should take up with the AAAS. And then when I was in graduate school working on my physics dissertation, I kind of picked up the hobby again, initially just as a diversion while working on my thesis research. And I kind of stuck with it. I don't really view it as a guilty pleasure because I don't believe in guilty pleasures. You know, snobbery is just the public face of insecurity. You like what you like, and you shouldn't feel guilty about it. And I've enjoyed this and continued on with it. And then teaching introductory physics classes, I started to bring them in slowly into the classroom in addition to examples from movies or Star Wars or Star Trek, just to kind of lighten things up and break things up. And then the university started this program of freshman seminars where they were encouraging us to come up with new classes not tied to any curriculum. And so it was kind of a challenge. Could I teach a real physics class only using superhero illustrations? And as much as possible, those cases where they would get the science right. And the class actually worked. We cover everything from Isaac Newton to the transistor, but there's not an inclined plane or pulley in sight. All the examples come from superhero comic books. As much as possible, those cases where the heroes get their science right.
You were the science consultant on the movie Watchmen. Was that the coolest thing you've ever done in your life?
Oh, it's definitely in the top. You know, obviously my family is very cool. I've got to say that. But in addition, my research, it's also been extremely cool. Anytime that I've made a discovery, no matter how small, that's an extremely wonderful feeling. But then going out to a Hollywood movie set and interacting with the director and the people involved was also extremely cool. And it's interesting because, you know, people who are fans of science fiction, superhero comic books or these other stories, are people who are turned on by ideas. And they like cool ideas. And if the cool ideas happen to be true, happen to be correct, because they're real science, they're still turned on by them. They're not, like, no longer interested. So these people are also very creative people, all very intelligent. And they dug the science. And they had a vested interest, a very selfish motive for talking to me. Because there are characters in these superheroes that are scientists, that are doing scientific things. And the more accurately that they can portray this in the film, any time the audience watching the movie is thinking, that's not what a real science lab looks like, or that looks wrong, is a moment where they're not following the story. And so just as good storytellers, they have a vested interest in trying to get the science right, or at least right enough for the film.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was freelancer Helen Fields talking with Jim Kekalius of the University of Minnesota about a session on the science of superheroes. You can find Helen Fields' blog posting on the session, as well as the full range of science's coverage of the meeting, at news.sciencemag.org. This has been a special science podcast from the 2010 AAAS Annual Meeting in San Diego, California. Special thanks to Karina Wu for her work on this show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.